Just like that, and just like that. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, Casey Rose.
Wow.
Now, we're not going to have a regular episode this week because we are doing a live show where we will discuss all that is going on in the Housewives world. The good, the bad, the ugly, and that is tonight, if you're listening to this today. Yes, it's listening today, so you still have time to get tickets.
And tonight's show has an incredibly surprise guest that you, I think, will absolutely love. And, we've also extended the time. If you can't make the actual show, you could still buy tickets and watch it for the next 5 days. Because it is a not-to-miss guest. We've never had a guest like this. We have.
No.
But not in this capacity. Let's just say it like that.
Yeah. No, this is exciting. But we will discuss all that is going on in the Housewives universe. Good, bad, ugly, the journey of it all. But in other news, we will be talking about something that we feel like we've been remiss on.
We have, because we've touched on it, but it is a cultural phenomena, a lightning rod, if you will. And I'm hearing from a lot of you, which are like, when are you going to discuss this? And then, the day has come and here we are. And to that point, I also want to say, Danielle, my sister wives, Elizabeth Lame and June Diane Raphael, have also, they're in the wings as well, because fans are very angry we haven't touched down on what's happening in that world as well. And we will be doing that soon, too.
It does seem like a lot is going on in that world because, I don't watch the show, but I'm aware of the players. And
right. You live on Earth.
Yeah, of course. I know what's happening. It seems to be people are, like rats on a ship just flying away from Mr. Cody and Coyote Pass. And
because Cody is only fucking Robin at this point, and that is really upsetting. And we're going to discuss it all. But right now, gosh, we have a guest that really is Sex and the City to me. He is Sex and the City. I think if anyone could be more than Sarah Jessica Parker or Michael Patrick King, it is he.
Now, you know him as the biggest Faniston, and he is. He is the biggest Faniston, but he is also on the other side of his Fanistonism. He's an SJPPP for life.
SJPP. And he's got so much to say about And Just Like That. And at the end of this very special episode in which we pick apart And Just Like That, and we have differing opinions we're all coming in with, hot takes. I'm sure we're all being triggered by things in our past and projecting things and loving things. But I do want to say we are going to drop into our feed. We're going to roll right into, and our guest is none other than Matthew McConkey.
Did we not say it already?
We didn't say his name, but there it is. Matt McConkey is fresh off of a hot, and I do mean a hot interview with Michael Patrick King, who's the Andy Cohen of course, And Just Like That. And he interviews him on his podcast with Dave Holmes, Homophilia. It is such an amazing interview. I truly laughed and cried, and I'm hoping that my beloved Michael Patrick King, who I love so much from The Comeback, isn't listening to this. No tagging. Because I have, and this is a safe space. Please welcome Matt McConkey.
Safe space-ish.
Okay.
I have felt it hasn't been a safe space with you, Matthew, and I love you, but
it hasn't. I mean, I've ended friendships.
Yeah. Because I am a Sex and the City lover. I've been watching since the beginning. In fact, strangely enough, you know who got me into Sex and the City? My dad.
Okay.
My father.
What?
Which is an interesting story because it was about the time The Sopranos came out. I think I was in college maybe. And he said, and I was watching The Sopranos, and my dad's like, you should be watching Sex and the City. He's like, my dad said, I can't get enough of these girls.
Well, he's got great taste, your dad.
He really does.
He does. He does. He says, they crack me up. They're a riot. That's what he said to me. And I was like,
just like Tony in the game.
Yeah, he was just like,
so riot.
He was like, yeah, Sopranos, all well and good, but I need to turn your eye. And he did. And I was like, I don't know, Dad. And my God, did he do. But I've been a lover since then, the late 90s, back in the good old days of the late 90s. And, but I do have opinions on this. And I do. And I don't know that I felt I could share them.
Yeah, and I don't know that you still can, to be honest, June and I have had to tell people regularly, this is not a safe space.
And me. Yeah.
This is not a safe space.
Because why, Matt? Why don't you tell everyone why? It's not, we're not safe here.
Because I, look, we're drowning in takes about this show more than ever. Michael told me this morning it is the most watched show on HBO Max. So
I love that. Wow. I love that.
As it should be.
As Michael Patrick King says in your show, Matt, it's great to be talked about at the end of the damn day, you know?
Exactly.
Better or worse.
And it's harder to be talked about now than it was when the show was on the first time.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Because then there was like, back, there was that and the Little Rascals. There was nothing else on TV.
It's hard to break through these days. Hard to break through.
It is.
Yeah.
And I'm in a place where, and I said this to my now dear friend, Michael Patrick King, where
yes,
I acknowledge it might just be the high, the rush of just like getting to be with our friends every week. It is such a high that we're all riding. But like in this moment, I can tell you honestly, I love And Just Like That more than Sex in the City. And in this moment, it's almost as if the screen is frozen, but I know it's not. Your faces. Oh, your faces. I wish people could see your faces.
And I respect you for being able to say that. I respect the hell out of you.
Yes. And to say it.
No upward inflection, like questioning.
No, just really stating that firmly. I felt you were in your lowest register, you know, like you were breathing into it too. So it felt real. And I just like the first episode back when Samantha wasn't there. And then
spoilers abound.
I think it was in the second episode. Spoilers, guys, big dies. When she had delivered the flowers, I was hysterical crying. And I realized because I am truly mourning Samantha.
Yeah, sure.
I am mourning Samantha. Not that I am not loving the addition of these wonderful other girls. I'm really into a lot of the new characters. I am enjoying them. I am enjoying their lives, their presence, what they bring to the show. But I am mourning Samantha. Are you not feeling that?
Have you moved on, Matt? From Sam?
And, you know, it's everyone is asking me, do I miss her? Of course, in the beginning, it was hard to accept that when I knew the show was coming without her, it was hard to accept. But now that I'm watching, do I miss her? It's like, not really. You know, to quote Luann, not really.
Not really. It's kind of like when NeNe left in a way where it's like, how could this huge presence that has come to define the show in many ways and kind of be the like, I do think SJP, of course, we all know how we feel about Carrie. She holds on the show. But Sam was kind of like the fan favorite. I mean, there's no other way to put it, right?
Yeah.
And then to lose her is such an absence. And yet Atlanta did march on, didn't it?
Yeah.
It did. And guys, know that I am watching Sex and the City the minute it hits the airwaves.
So am I. I'm watching it during the day. I don't, and I know I, again, for a living, cover trash television, but I don't watch Our Housewives during the day. I'll wait at night when I'm cozied in and like on pills, but I watch, when I see it come up, it's like 11 a.m., I'm popping it on.
Oh, same.
And I'm doing a mix of a love watch and a hate watch, which, you know, I'm on this chain and in Just Like That chain with you and June, Matt, and you guys have had to reprimand me because
a couple times
you guys asked that this be a safe space in that you just didn't want to hear one bit of criticism, like not an ounce, nothing.
No. And I know that yours is coming from a place of love. Yeah, there's just not too much room for it. There's just, you know, the discourse has gotten so deafening, especially around, I'll tell you what I never want to talk about again is Che Diaz. There's nothing new to say about Che that hasn't been said. Nothing new under the sun.
No, again, Sara Mirez, they're a fantastic actor. Like, incredible.
Absolutely.
But here's my problem, which you don't want to know, but like, I don't have a problem with Che Diaz. I have a problem in general, and I think it's a really hard thing to do on television, is to present a stand-up.
I think it worked on your show, Danielle Hacks.
Very much so.
Yes,
because
yes.
Hacks was about a great stand-up, and that was represented properly. Che isn't funny, and that's okay.
That's the problem, because then the cut to the audience.
Well,
at the Pride Week and stuff. And it's like, they're all laughing as if a joke has been told. And I'm like,
okay, how many comedians do we know in our lives who have big followings, Netflix specials, popular podcasts, who simply aren't funny?
Okay. This is a hot take, Matt.
There are plenty. It's simply a realistic depiction to me.
I disagree. Matt. All my friends, Matt. My friends with Netflix specials are very fucking funny.
So Matt, like, but are you also going to take that logic one step further? So like when we see the audience, like Danielle's saying, when we see the audience laughing at Che Diaz's jokes, you're saying some people are laughing at our friends that are stand-ups and they're not funny.
100%.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, are you taking into account the writer's intentions in that moment? You just think whatever happened worked. It worked.
Exactly. You're yeah. saying, am I gonna?
Like the chips fell where they may. I'm sorry, Matt. I gotta go back. So you're saying what you feel to be revolutionary about Che Diaz is that they're not a good stand-up, and that feels very right to you, and that feels like fresh.
I can't go on record saying that I believe that to be the writer's intentions. I'm not clear about. You know, I also listen, people should check out their Writer's Room podcast, which is excellent, wherever your podcast is just called, and just like that, the Writer's Room. And they do really answer a lot of questions. I don't think I've ever heard them say specifically, we wanted Che to not be a funny comedian. But what I am saying,
but maybe that was just they hadn't gotten there yet. They haven't gotten there yet.
But yeah, maybe that's going to be the finale reveal.
But you're thinking it's working for you big time.
It's working for me.
I'm just saying it makes me same with like I love The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. That's another one of like a show I just love. I get caught in the fantasy, the fashion, the Jewishness. Sure. Even though I don't think there's an actual Jew on the show, but that's not for today. But I love the vibe of the show. But when I watch the stand-up scenes, I do get uncomfortable sometimes. And it's tough to watch. But how I contain myself is I'm like, well, this is the 1950s. So sure. Stand-up was different. You know, like I can kind of like be like, oh, it was a different world back then. I don't have to kind of like, I just get.
Seems like they're going for like a Hannah Gadsby thing with Che a bit. Mixed with like Carrot Top or something.
But I laughed at Hannah Gadsby. Same. I laughed throughout.
I said Hannah going Gadsby's for. Special. I said they're going for.
Right. But I do want to just get back to why I love this show more than most things in my life. And in this moment, again, I love it more than Sex and the City. I almost love it more. I can't even say it. I almost said it.
Say it.
Just for effect, I was going to say love it more than Jen, but who am I kidding?
But what? But you are feeling these feelings, Matt. This is incredibly real, and that's why we brought
this
you on here.
This is very real. I'll tell you this. I didn't watch season two of The Morning Show the day that every episode dropped the way I am with this one. But here's the
thing. That's big, Matt.
The level of the depth of the friendships are so moving, and you just you're not going to get that when you're younger and you're running around New York and you're walking through, you know, relationships and breakups and having kids in the early years and stuff together. Like when you're older and you're 20 and 30 years into these friendships, then you're walking through death together, literal death. And, you know, the metaphorical death of the Samanthas.
And divorce and, you know, the breakup of marriages and the changes in relationship and people. And I will say I do think that they have handled death beautifully. I think that is a hard thing to handle. And they haven't swept over it. You know what I mean? The way a lot of shows do.
But I want them to sweep over it. And here's why. I like to watch Sarah Jessica Parker as I want my Carrie light on her feet. Instead, I've got her like in a dress that's swallowing or eating Cheez-Its in the windowsill. Like, I want to see her fun, not just like, you know, kind of downtrodden Carrie. And I just wish, and I know we wouldn't really buy it. And I probably would. And Michael says this on your podcast, Matt. But like, I probably would be annoyed too if in like one episode she was like getting rammed. But like, at the same time, where is the sex? And I know this isn't just like but give me some sex. Give me some lightness. John Tenney, where art thou? You used to be so gorgeous and hot. What am I to believe? What am I to believe about her new love pair? Am I to say wow? Am I to say no? I don't know what they want me to feel.
We have seen two dicks in That's one right. episode, which was a pleasure. Hair, speaking of, Harry is so, I feel, very well endowed.
Big dick Harry.
That was a prosthetic. I don't want
to
speak
to that for sure.
And that was a choice that the writers made, which I agree with, which is that they think Harry would be very well endowed.
Absolutely. Well endowed. Which is not to say the actor's not. Who knows?
And I was like, is this a Charlotte choice or is this a writer's choice? I'm curious what you think. When Miranda in last week's episode said, I'm getting a divorce, like I'm asking Steve for a divorce, I'm going to tell him everything. They were all kind of like, ooh, oh my God, you know, Charlotte had that thing. And then she went right into the thing about like the blowjob thing. And I was like, but the divorce is on the table. Like we have, like that felt like, I didn't know. I was just like, but if it were my friends, we would be like, but wait, okay, we'll get back to the blowjob, but you're going to have a divorce. Like this feels like a huge moment for Miranda. Why aren't we?
And for the flip of that, Danielle, what got me is in the scene of the picnic when Cynthia Nixon is saying, I'm unhappy with my, you know, kind of catching Charlotte up to speed. The acting is unparalleled. I'm not even touching that. Cynthia Nixon deserves an Emmy for this season, for sure.
So
do I want to see her get fingered again? No. But what I will say is this. I didn't understand why Carrie's being so mean to Miranda. I mean, I know she had sex while she was like rolling around in her urine, but...
But it's also her boss. I think there was also like, you're fucking my boss.
She felt so mean. I'm like, your friend is like clearly struggling and trying to find their footing. I don't know. I don't like the colors I'm forced to see on Carrie.
I understand that.
I didn't mind
she
that.
She did soften. Carrie did soften after she understood the... I mean, remember Miranda yelling at her, I'm not happy?
Yeah, that was
beautiful. That was incredible.
Oh, wow.
David Kasp saw that. He's been watching it sometimes before me, my husband.
What?
Yes, loves it. And he goes, there is a monologue in this that's truly one of the most beautiful monologues performed I've ever seen on TV. And it was Cynthia Nixon's monologue at the foot of the bed when she said, I'm unhappy. Yeah. She's incredible.
She's incredible. And I hear you. I mean, I think that I've appreciated the moments of lightness we've got. I think that more moments of lightness were coming. But another thing in the discourse here is that everyone is like, the show's too sad. I want to be drinking Cosmos. But it's like, these are sad times, babe. Like, why?
Okay, I hear you. I hear you. Okay, that felt very pointed.
Not at all.
The one thing I do love about the show and is the ultimate fantasy of the show. To me, right now, as a person watching it right now, is that that COVID's over.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That
it
happened and that it just went away. And like, they're
living in a post. You want wish fulfillment? There's your wish fulfillment.
And it's so forward thinking. It's like most shows are like, we're not at COVID or it never happened. They're like, oh, it did. And I love that.
It happened, but it's over. I'm so happy there because I'm like, we got through it. We all okay, we're worse for the wear, but we're through it. And that is the ultimate fantasy right now.
Agreed.
For me.
If I can jump back to what I said about Miranda getting fingered, here's where I'm at with it. It's more just that, well, what David refers to as her finger in sweats. You know, she's in Mara's sweats and getting fingered left, right, and center in them. And I'm just, where the straw broke the camel's back for me was the scene with her and Steve in the kitchen. That was hard.
That was hard, but
watch.
It was hard for her to live through. I mean, they wanted it to be hard.
Wow.
But here, this herein lies the crux of the issue. On one hand, we're saying, where's the sex? And on the other hand, here's the sex, and we're saying, we don't want it.
And you're right, Matt. And Michael Patrick King mentions this too, which is like, I do think it's become, it truly, I sound like a terrible critic, but like, it's like a lightning rod in that I think in terms of aging, some of the things I'm bumping up against, I'm realizing like, oh, those are my issues with things, I think. Or maybe I don't want to see that. Like, it's definitely hitting a nerve to where I'm like saying like, we're all, I think, adjusting to the thing of like, oh, yeah, these gals were 30 years younger. I think they look so beautiful now. 1,000,000%. So beautiful. But it's like, oh, wow, we are like, it's so interesting what they've done. They've actually titled this a different show. When I really think about it, I'm coming around to you, Matt. It isn't Sex and the City, is it? It's Unjust Like That.
It's in Just Like That. Now, I would like to talk about a character for who I've been seeing sort of a sliding doors life for. And I've been thinking a lot about him lately, which is Steve. Because when he was doing another wonderful acting performance, and he's not, you know, like, again, a man with a hard voice that has become a sex. I mean, wow. Just Miranda. Like, it's, who would have thought?
Now, is that his voice or is that a character choice?
I think it's his voice. I believe it's his voice. I don't know for sure. But now I think of him and remember that, like, and I don't remember her name and I'm sorry, everybody, but she was sort of like a young girl that he was with. After Miranda was pregnant, they had Brady, and he had met this girl, and she didn't ask a lot for him. She was an uncomplicated woman, and she loved him so much, so simply, so purely, and loved him so much. And I picture a sliding doors life for him where that could have been his wife. Right. You know, they would have, you know, like, he deserved someone like that. And that's his fault because he could have had her. He could have said, no, like, Miranda, you always do this to me. You break up. And the speech he basically gave her in Just Like That, which is like, you do this all the time. You get mad, you da-da-da, you say I'm not happy, and then we get back, and then you want me back. And she did that to Skipper, too. Remember Skippy whatever his name was. Yes. In the first few seasons. But I do picture this sliding doors life for him. What if he had married her? I wonder if he would have been happier.
I do think he would have been happy. But I think he is simply a person who is easier to make happy. Happiness comes more easily to him than it does to Miranda.
But then why did he choose such a complicated woman?
That's always the case.
Who he could never make happy.
Well, right. But he was happy just trying, you know? Mm. And that's the beauty of Steve. But Miranda, I mean, how many Steves did you date? Have you dated in your day where you were like
a million Steves?
You know, I could do. Like, he's great. He's great.
Yeah, he's a loving guy. He's nice. He loves me.
Yeah. What kind of monster would I be to say no to this? And then you do it, and eventually you go.
But she did. She broke up with him a million times, and then she kept breaking up with him.
Well, it's interesting because there's a lot of criticism of like, well, why would Miranda suddenly be gay? And this isn't about Cynthia Nixon. And it's like, I totally, though, believe this storyline. That is one thing where I'm like, what? Of course. Like, to me, it tracks so fucking perfectly. Like, yes, she was kind of on the fence about Steve, who is a nice guy. And she was always sort of like not quite settled in that spot. And I think this is like a genius, perfect, natural next step for Miranda. Cynthia Nixon aside.
Me too. 100%. That to me is seamless.
Now, I did feel with the scene when she broke up with Steve, there was like something a little off with it in the sense of she's doing such amazing acting. It almost felt like they filmed it separately and like sewed it together. Like he was talking really fast and she was having this very emotional scene. These are not things I need to be picking apart. I just something was going on there where I either wanted the scene to be longer. It just suddenly felt so quick. Huh. And I'm like, we've been with this relationship so long. I actually like wanted more, I think, there or something.
Well, as always, I think the show is one step ahead and they're going to give you more next week.
Right, because now we know that Miranda's, you know, getting on the airplane to go see Che. And, of course, we have Che's last words ringing in our ears. I can't do a traditional thing. And Miranda will have probably misinterpreted that.
It's going to go well.
And then are we crawling back to Steve?
Oh, God. I think we're missing Steve. And, you know, at the end of the day, maybe they will end up in the exact thing that Che thought they were in, which is an open marriage.
Mm.
You know? Maybe there's happiness to be found there.
I don't think he could have an open marriage. I don't.
Maybe he'll go back to that simpler lady that you're referring to from days gone by.
Yeah, I feel for Steve. I think, but I also want Miranda to be free. So, and she's a fucking phenomenal actress.
Phenomenal.
Ugh. And she's getting to shine in ways she's not shown in the old series to me. So, you know, people would always be like, I don't want to be the Miranda. Like that was a familiar refrain. Now I'm like, oh, I want to be the Miranda.
I am watching her in a new show that I am loving.
Gilded Age?
Called The Gilded Age.
How is it?
I've heard different things. Good friends of ours, and I won't mention who, were like, it's terrible. It's tough to watch. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Maybe because I didn't have high hopes and I'm not finished with the episode, but she's playing a very different character, kind of like a sweet, simple woman.
Playing like a Charlotte, basically.
She's delight and like kind of like an old, like she's just kind of like this woman in like the 1800s who's unmarried, but you know, in her 50s, like an old aunt and like, you know, but so different and a joy. Mm. She's incredible. Guys, she's incredible.
It's her season. It's not Sarah Jessica Parker's season. I wonder if they knew that going in.
No, it's not. I will say one character I'm having trouble with, who I have always enjoyed thoroughly, is Charlotte.
Oh, really?
Yes, guys, I've loved Charlotte. I thought she was so funny.
You know, Matt's made me Charlotte at his wedding.
Well, but for me, that is the highest.
See, I do love Charlotte. I love
such a renaissance with Charlotte right now.
me too.
I am not because I have loved her. I have loved her through all the movies. I have loved her through the TV show. She was fun. She was sweet. She was like
you were always there for her.
I was there for her when some people were not. Some people did not think that she like stood out amongst the ladies. And I was like, oh no, she's a star. They're all stars. Like I was like, she is incredible.
But then like if you pull this Kim string, are you kind of left more with the spotlight on Charlotte?
I don't know if I'm not liking the storylines or the performance. Like I'm liking this, like even the stuff with her daughters, it's not ringing true for the act. I don't know if it's the acting or the right. Something is ringing false about it to me. Is this just me? I don't know. But
you
like,
mean, is your take wrong? Yes, I've tried to tell you that. Yes, it is.
Yeah,
no, I'm kidding.
I'm with you, Matt. I love Kristen Davis, and I agree. It's like a little bit of a different Charlotte than we've seen, but she's making me laugh. Like, is she Meryl Streep? No, but to me, she's really funny and goes down so easy.
But that's what I thought in the show and in this series. Maybe I just feel like she's playing a different tune than everybody. I don't know.
Well, like everybody else has dropped in deeper because they've had to with their storylines. Yes. And it does feel like she's kind of existing in a more shallow, like icing place, whereas Cynthia Nixon's dropped down. Now Sarah Jessica Parker's mourning. And now we have Kristen Davis left to do like physical comedy on a tennis court dressed in a costume that I would murder every costume person on that set.
Yeah,
you didn't like the tennis look?
No.
I didn't understand the fight between her and Harry. Like, that storyline was like, what's happening? He wants her to apologize? What a puss. I was just like, no, Harry, no.
You've spoken like a true Charlotte.
Yeah. Yeah, I was kind of like, let her play tennis the way she wants to. But
Matthew, what would you call me? And not by the look I'm sporting right now, because it's the end of a long day and I've been working all day. Let me take off my glasses.
Well, he's seen you before, Danielle.
I know, but I need him to see me through new eyes.
Yeah, Matt, if you had to cast Danielle
in your wedding.
Okay, and I'm going to think too. Okay.
It's interesting.
Am I not a main cast member?
Mario Cantone. We've talked about this once before. I always come up with Mario Cantone for you.
As long as it's not
me. I love him.
No, I love him too. I love him too.
I love him. He has been a bright spot in the series too.
He really has.
I love him.
You know, aside from the obvious in that you are a classic Che Diaz.
because you're
an amazing comedian and an amazing podcast host, which is
thank you.
What makes you so not a Che. Honestly, I do feel like you're a Charlotte too. And for me, that is the highest praise that you can give to a friend, because like even going back and looking at the old episodes and watching the first movie, obviously the second movie we just gloss over, like the way in which Charlotte has just never needed the spot, like, you know, we all have a friend who's just like doesn't demand the spotlight in the same way that all of us do, I guess.
I do.
But, you know, that she's just so happy to be there for her friends. That's really like all she wants is for her family to be happy and safe and for her friends to be happy and safe. And like, that is more than enough for her. And like, that is.
And for you.
It's just so beautiful.
Oh,
you know,
she's so beautiful.
It's.
Yeah. Well, that's not in doubt.
No, it's incredible. I mean, you know, for the new characters.
Yeah, like, let's get into those gals.
I'd like to get into the new characters.
LTW, Charlotte's friend, is probably the weakest link, only in that we just haven't gotten enough of her.
Oh, I love her.
I'm enjoying her and her husband's marriage. I am enjoying her fashion. I am enjoying the sort of, I liked the look on her the week when she was just like, the sort of like where her husband was taking the spotlight and she was like nervous. Mm. Like, I liked all that.
Oh, and by the way, Nicole Ari Parker is a star.
She's a star to me. But where I get less invested in the storyline is that we're peeling off with with Karen Pittman, who's also an incredible actress.
Oh, yeah.
Within the fertility world and journey, I just wish they would like tie it a little closer into the show in some ways. Mm.
Well, you mean because Charlotte had her fertility journey, so maybe like, you know, like...
No, like we're going like a full story in their house, and whereas like we're not really going home with Nicole a ton in the way I'd like, you know? Divorced from Charlotte. Like we're playing Nicole as Charlotte's pal. I, meanwhile, would want to go home with Nicole and like really do some time with her personally.
Yes.
But I'm loving Sarita.
Sima, the best.
Sima is, I'm loving Sima. Like SEMA has...
Living for SEMA.
Living for SEMA.
The definition of a breath of fresh.
Yes.
Sarita Chowdhury.
She's everything.
But I think that they are just dipping a toe in the waters of like going home with those characters a bit. This is a half an hour and we still have to service our Carrie and Miranda and a Charlotte. But I think that we're getting there.
I want more time.
I think we're. Yeah. I know. Believe me, I would. This needs to be a 2-hour episode every week, as far as I'm concerned.
I am sad when it's wrapping up. So I feel like I've almost struck a harsher note in the way that, because, you know, comedy is also, you know, and maybe not for Jay Diaz, but about bouncing off of a strong opinion, which yours is to love it, Matt. But as we're talking, I'm like, I love this show. I don't know why I'm being harsh on it. It's you don't see women in this way with these in these topics. Now, it's gotten a lot of flack for bringing in new characters and trying to, like, quote unquote, Cynthia Nixon, saying like, we're trying to fix it. And I think people wanted it. I think just people want, there's some people that wanted it to be the light, frothy thing it was. And it's like, it's not. But I also think it's got something big to offer.
I think I'm starting to settle into it. You know, it's so hard to reboot a series and reboot a series, you know, 20 years later. And it was such a beloved series and so many expectations. I can't imagine as a writer what that feels like. I'm sure it'll feel the same when I reboot Hot Wives. It'll be exactly
absolutely
the same.
And the outrage will be the beloved. Same. And we'll be on here defending you the same way. What I was going to say about the Charlotte thing is that it all connects for me back to the big thing, because, you know, there was also a lot of outrage about the way that he was killed off, the fact that it happened so early. And, you know, I'm of the mindset that, and this is before any of the Chris Noth scandal stories came out, that Big needed to die. I believe I'm better off without him. I think we're all better off without him.
And we had to drive story with that. Yes, we had to launch from there.
The way that he died was
the death.
Yeah, it wasn't the death.
It was also just that no one called 911. Like, that was so hard for me to do with, like.
Right.
I allowed that was like a space and time of like a slow frame and everything. I didn't want to see him masturbate. You know, there were things.
Yes. The fact that after the death, the conversation was all like, Charlotte feels guilty that she made Carrie go to the recital when she could have been with Big. Carrie feels guilty that she didn't just go to the Hamptons with Big like she wanted to, but she went to the recital instead. And meanwhile, not a single person has said, why didn't we just fucking make him drag his ass to the recital that was so important for Charlotte? Steve was there. You know, the husbands were there. Like,
The fact they knew he wouldn't go.
And that's why it's like, maybe Carrie didn't need a guy who was always, you know, it's just, I hate that kind of husband where it's just understood that, like, he has his way and he's only going to be, you know, part of my life to a certain extent. It's like, all these people who are at the recital are the people who were there for all those years while you were jerking around, leaving her at the altar, marrying fucking a piece of paper named Natasha, doing everything you did. Like, you should be so lucky that they're all still in your lives. Get your ass to the recital. And then maybe you'll have your heart attack there, and there'll be a doctor in the house.
Wow, Matt.
This is a take I've never thought of, and I am blown away by this take.
Allow me to pull up to quote to me, because you know what it's reminding me so much of, Matt? There's a crazy lady on Instagram that we know to be Dr. Deb, Bronwyn's mother. This is all going to come together. I beg you to know it will.
Okay.
Now, as crazy as she is in the sense of like, oh, well, we're all looking one way and thinking like she's crazy. And we're thinking, oh, Big should have, you know, all of these things happened. And so it's a fresh take of looking at an old thing that we blame things on. So this woman's Instagram is the single most insane and unhinged Instagram that exists on the platform. And I check it every night, and I'm so invested and involved in it. But she hit us with something. Now, sometimes she's on the toilet, on psychedelics. You know, things are happening. But she really hit us with a quote that is kind of reframing things the way you're reframing the fact that Big should have been at the fucking recital. And that's on Big, right? And his past behavior. Now, this is a totally different topic, but here's how about this reframing? How did daddy issues become an insult to girls when it's men who failed as fathers?
How did
daddy issues become an insult to girls when it's men who failed as fathers?
Wow. Yes. 1000%. The daddies are the ones with the issues.
Yeah. And we've been blaming the girls and making fun of them as though they bestowed this upon. They are the reason for this. Now, maybe that was like not the most connected thing for you guys, but in my head, I felt it. Danielle, too sure.
Well, no, I was going to tell you because you sent me that day because you were like, this is, I can't believe Dr. Deb. And I meant to tell you, which I didn't tell you, which because Dr. Deb did not credit the person, but she had actually reposted that from somebody else. So it wasn't her.
Oh, I know Dr. Deb didn't write this. Oh, I know. Oh, God, guys. God, I'm just saying for Dr. Deb's brain to even think to repost that was so thrilling. Oh, God, I would never give Dr. Deb credit for that. It comes for credit as she's just credited simply as at girl.
The iconic.
But that's what that was my face.
And she's always doing hashtags. One of them is healthy parenting.
Oh, yeah. She's such a healthy parent. As you can see, she's really paid that forward.
Oh, interesting, Matt. It's a beautiful read on Big. You're right. It's like he should be so fucking lucky.
Like if you told me like Max has this recital tonight and it's like the most important thing in his life and I've got you two tickets, the idea that Michael would not be obligated to go to that, whether or not he wanted to go to the fucking Hamptons, is a joke.
Wow. That's beautiful, Matt. See, I would probably let David stay home. Wow.
Well, I would expect his ass.
You know, I am feeling really badly about some of the things I said because I don't know why I was trying to be kind of like, I don't know. It felt forced, felt a little pushed because I really I'm enjoying it. I'm sort of like, it's like when you pick something apart that you do love. And I have a sauce up for like the scene between Seema and Carrie at the bar. Oh. Remember they had that scene and Carrie said that kind of errant comment to Seema. And then later when they hashed that out and Seema was like, you know, the comment you made about like, it's good for you that you're still trying or whatever. That was some of the most beautiful acting on television. When they drop into a scene and it's not as, Sarah Jessica Parker really has to do some puns that are tough, but she always has. And she's always made them sing. Mm-hmm. Oh, but when they drop into acting, it's so amazing. They're so good.
It's the best thing on TV. And it's what makes that friendship suddenly a real friendship. And there is a lot of criticism about the ways in which the new characters who are women of color have been introduced, which I understand there is a clunkiness to it that suddenly each of the white women has what seems to be sort of a side friend who is a woman of color.
Very clunky, yeah.
But I will say, I don't think there was a perfect way to do this because it obviously needed to be done. If we're going to do it, and they're all the first people to say like that was this just glaring mistake that they made the first time around. And it's glaring to the point that like, if you're going to try to correct it, there's going to be some major growing pains no matter what. I appreciate that they tried. Mm-hmm.
I will say that all these new characters have made the show interesting and better. Yes. Where I am having my issues personally, and I think it's, again, probably my issues, is when it's the three of them. Mm. Sometimes when I feel the shift or the punt, like something sometimes to me, but maybe it's just like I'm stuck in the past.
Where it's like if someone's died, sometimes you don't want to go around the old friends that you were with them. Yeah. It seems like that's where you're having a hard time is settling in with the gang without.
You're feeling Samantha's absence there.
Yeah, and maybe it is also that, like, you know, I'm younger than the women in Sex and the City, but I am, you know, older and wiser, but also filled with more trauma now than I was back then. And so it isn't as light anymore with the three of them as it used to be. And I'm not as light. And maybe it's my own trauma that I'm living. That I'm going to cry, but like that I'm living with now. You know what I mean? Like the life that, you know, I'm not as light as I was. I have heaviness. And it doesn't mean that I don't have joy like they do, but it's like maybe it's triggering for me, you know, because it feels heavier.
Yeah.
It is heavier. No, that makes a ton of sense.
Total sense. You know? Yeah.
And I think for me, that is why it just gives me more hope about getting older and our friendships growing over the years, you know, that
You guys, it's the best show on TV.
I know. I'm like, I love it so much. Seeing it through your eyes, Matt, and also seeing it through my eyes, like, I don't know why I tried to be obstinate. Danielle, it was beautiful. And
it is.
I think what you're saying, Danielle, is right. It's like, it's hard to see these girls that have been there for us to tune out to. It would almost be like watching The Housewives in 20 years and seeing them like grounded and like deep, you know, burying husbands. It's like, whoa, okay. I'm just used to kind of seeing them for me to tune out. And this show does kind of, it demands a little bit from you.
It does.
Emotionally. It does. In a good way.
And Michael Patrick says this in the interview, but like that, it has been, I think, a little bit of a collective like rewriting of history about the show, because yes, it was frothy and fun, but like the best episodes were always the ones when shit did hit the fan, like when Miranda's mother died, the funeral, I can't even. We cried talking about this in the interview, because it's like what happens there between that, you know, Samantha not being able to express emotion, yes, and then Miranda being self-conscious that she's like has to, you know, enter the church.
And when Carrie has to go like hold her up. Oh my God.
That's the moment.
But even some of those early fights, like when I'm talking like first and second season, when it was still pretty frothy, but like some of those fights when like Carrie had just got broken up with Big and she couldn't get over it. And Miranda was like, just get fucking over it. And then they have that finally when she realizes like, oh, I hid from my old boyfriend today. And I realize like, and they're at the diner. Do you remember that? And she's just like, I'm sorry. Like, I forgot how hard it is.
Yes.
And like, just those beautiful, like beautiful scenes that were really real and really, but yeah, but there is more baggage. They come with more baggage now. And so do I.
We all do. But, you know, let's embrace it. I mean, the last thing I would say about the new characters is like, even if it has felt clunky at times, the way they've been introduced and brought into the group, because of scenes like the one you're talking about with Carrie and Seema, like now I'm invested in a way where if there is a season two, God willing, and Seema just fully drives her own story, I'm in. I'm completely in.
Yeah.
You know, and whereas if they had just dropped us into the world and suddenly there are four new friends and we never acknowledge like how they all came to be, it would have been like a cheat. It would have been a shortcut.
Yeah. They've created a new show. And that to me has been incredibly successful given the footprint that the old one has. It's almost literally impossible.
Yeah.
It's a new show with old characters. It's almost like when the Golden Girls went to the Golden Palace.
Yes.
And then and Bea Arthur didn't join.
Yeah. Except Bea Arthur showed up. You know, she made some cameos, whereas, as we know, that's not going to happen with our missing fourth here. Although I did ask him about that. About Kim Cattrall. And I wasn't trying to even, it's like, what is there to say about it that hasn't already been said?
There's a lot for me. Yeah.
You know, we all know that like she's gone full scorched earth and like she's not coming back. But I was just trying to get at like, are you guys behind closed doors in the writer's room trying to creatively leave doors open? You know, this has been such a love letter to her character. Like she's been handled with, she's been honored so beautifully.
Beautiful gloves, yes.
If by some miracle she saw that and it spoke to her heart and she was moved, is there any chance?
Like when she got when she texted, Samantha, and she was like, "Hey, there's this story."
Yeah, she's literally, we're being moved by characters that aren't even on screen.
I know
that don't want to be there. Yeah.
When she texted her and she's like, it's my best story or whatever, I was like, I cried, like, because I'm like, I miss Sam Jones. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I miss my friend. The way that they miss their friend, I miss my friend, you know? And I want to see where she is.
Yeah. I do too. Okay. I mean, do you think that there's any way, you know, you've mobilized the Bitch Sesh listeners to do such important things for charity and philanthropy that, I don't know, maybe there's a way that collectively we can bring our energy together for the most important cause of all, which is getting Kim to join them on season two. Can you imagine?
Here's how I want it. We don't know she's coming back. We assume we don't have her. We've had the worst fight they've ever, you know, this is terribly public what's happened and like unbelievable. Like sometimes I'll just stare off and I'll think, did Kim really like put that Instagram up?
Right on Instagram.
Like admonishing Sarah love. Jessica Parker for reaching out about the loss of her brother? Like, I'm like, did that happen or did I make that up? It was so dark, so, so terribly dark. But then I'm like, okay, almost like, do you remember when Maria comes back in The Sound of Music and they're all singing sadly and then they think they hear a voice that's joined their chorus and she just appears at the top of the hill with her, like, I want to see her with her bags, like, hi, girls! And they're like, Sam, like, to get that would be so heartening. I think it could bring us all a ton of healing. Like, I do think instead of us, like, forcing this discourse and this thing of, like, she's against her and she's against her, couldn't we write Kim and just say, gosh, we loved your character and we love you and we respect everything that's happened here. But it would just give your fans a chance to process if we could actually see you again.
Yeah.
I think I could let her go if I could see her again, if that makes sense. And say goodbye.
See, if she comes back, I don't think I can let her go.
Again. Right. Okay.
And here, yes, I can't let her go again. Once she comes back, I can't let her go again. And here's where housewives are the best. And again, we take it back to the housewives. It's like, because there are things that have been said between housewives that you do not think people can come back
from.
You
can't.
You know, like, just think of like Nene and Portia, who are, I think, good friends again. Yeah. You know what I mean? A death has happened. I think the Greg's death, like, they have said some of the worst things in public that two women can say to each other. And yet,
I hear Candace and Ashley are palling around right now. I mean, these are tough things.
And like just scorched earth stuff. Like, if they can come back together, can we get these ladies?
That Project Runway episode with where they address the housewives, and you got to see just little moments of Karen and Giselle having laughs together.
Yes.
And like that is a sliver of a fraction of the collective joy we would feel if we could heal this.
And I think Kim thinks that it's like they want me back and I'm not going to give that to them. It's like, actually, I think it would be so good for Kim.
100%. And, you know, she is
to go into the light.
How I Met Your Father, you know, so she's working and she looks amazing. So, you know, she's working and always will. But I cannot imagine that she'll or anyone could experience like a cultural phenomenon like she would experience if she came back.
Yes. And what like what more beautiful story? Like, did it feel like there was any window? Like, could Michael Patrick King, Sarah Jessica Parker, maybe Andy Cohen goes as well, maybe Bruce Bozzi's there. And do we fly to London and just say, just give us 5 minutes to make right whatever you feel happened? Give us one cameo.
Yeah.
I always think these things, the door could be open, you know?
Yes. And I think that the door is open because they could have done her dirty creatively. Like we could have made a joke out of what happened to her, but.
Or they could have killed
exactly.
her.
Exactly.
That could have been her on that Peloton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With a body double from the back. Or her like getting, you know, you know, they could have done her. She's getting fucked on the side of the Peloton, bent over. We don't see her. She's dead. These are things that could have happened.
Absolutely.
But they gave her beautiful moments where she wasn't even on screen. Like I said, sending those flowers.
And I believe she did all those things in my heart.
Oh, I think Kim Cattrall sent those flowers.
I do too. Like, I was like, she gave that text.
Yeah. Like, I'm like, I feel like they're texting each other. Like, I feel like she's on the other end of the line, guys.
Yeah, something so unsettled there for me. It was like when Shirley MacLaine and Deborah Winger fought all these years. It's like, I need this to be made right.
Yeah.
I do.
I do too.
And that'll be a lot of forgiveness on Sarah Jessica's part.
And we've experienced such collective trauma over the last few years that we need some collective wins.
Yeah, it's like.
And I think that this, some coming together.
After what we've been through, you know, politically and, you know, with this pandemic, I think that Kim Cattrall has a duty to do this. Mm. And I am not getting an obligation.
Not kidding at all.
And I hope she hears this, and I don't know if we can get this to her, but we think this could heal some nations and some people.
Yeah. Danielle's been in tears many times in this episode alone. Like, I think this is quite real where we've landed, which is that we need Kim. And again, we're not asking for more than I'm not asking for more than a big group hug. And I've missed you girls. One scene at the coffee shop, then she's work calls. She's got to head back to London quick.
Just the thought of that gave me.
I know. Yeah. Girls, I've missed you so. That's what I want.
Ugh,
it's almost, you know, like it feels almost dangerous to fantasize about, you know?
It really does. So like, feelings are being stirred up.
Big time.
Wow. Matt, are there any closing words?
Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving me the space to talk about this and to cry about this, you know, the very best thing that's happening in our lives. On Homophilia, we gotta interview every single week. Do I like every guest? No, I don't. But
I don't think you have to put down the other guests.
Michael Patrick King. Yeah. I mean, was just so generous, so generous to the extent that like we went twice as long as we were supposed to go. So it's a two-part episode.
It's a two-parter. And we're going to put out the first part and then you got to subscribe to Homophilia and get at that second part.
Thank you.
This is great journalism. The way you interview him, I you're so prepared. It's so amazing.
I've just never cared about anything this much.
And again, I mean, he created my favorite show, The Comeback. This man is a genius.
The fact that he could give us both things is just,
yeah.
It's just we're so lucky to be alive at a time where he's still creating shows.
And I want to say that you're a brilliant interviewer in general, Matt. If you listen, for those of you, I would hope that our fans of Bitch Sesh are already subscribers to Homophilia.
Give us just the log line for Homophilia, Matt, in case anybody is not a listener.
Homophilia is a podcast I host with Dave Holmes, who's a brilliant writer and was a VJ on MTV for a long time. So he has a great following and he's a true host, a polished host in the truest sense, whereas I am a little more of a rambling wanderer in a conversation as
a Che Diaz, if you will.
Sure.
Danielle.
You gotta have one. I know. I would say I'm the Bob. What is the guy's name who's on the podcast?
Oh, Bobby Lee.
I'm the Bobby Lee to Dave's Che Diaz.
We didn't even get into that whole thing. Okay, go on.
And we interview a different LGBTQ entertainer, a person of note every week. We ask our log line is kind of like, tell us about what you love and who you love. So we get into like, what are your pop culture obsessions, and then we get into, most importantly, who are you sleeping with? Tell us about your sex life.
Ooh. But you also get into a lot of times, oftentimes, like coming out stories. And it's such a beautiful show and really funny, of course, but it's also really beautiful.
And great interviews with some of Bitch Sesh faves, like the one Mr. Andrew Cohen. And there is an interview with the hot priest, which
baby,
Andrew Scott.
That was a big one.
And you've had some big ones.
T.S. Madison and Tig Notaro and Alan Cumming and they're just like, it is a crazy. I loved all
icons.
Those people I mentioned when I say I didn't like certain guests. We'll talk about those.
But it's such a great show. So everyone listen to the Michael Patrick King one right after this. You will it'll be in the feed, but there's so many great interviews, so I hope everybody really gets to touch down, but which I can't believe they wouldn't be, because
yeah. But if you haven't get into Matt's podcast and get to watch and just like that, you know, we've got how many more episodes? Two, Matt?
Yeah, two.
Okay, see, that made me sad when I heard two. I felt sad, so I know I came in very combative, very hot, and I'm sorry, Matt.
And I came in sort of cavalier.
You did.
I came in like, not like I hate this or I love this, but like
what is it that don't impress me much.
Yes, yeah. I think I came in like there's good, there's bad, but like whatevs. And now I'm like,
yeah, and then you cried several times, so I think that my work here is
just
done.
Speaking about it, Danielle.
Yeah,
guys, I'm unwell.
No.
And just like that, my work here is done. You know,
I've
broken you both
beautiful.
Down.
Wow.
And it's my greatest honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt McConkie. Thank you, Renee. Thank you, Caitlin. And enjoy this incredible episode of Homophilia.
And then also, don't forget, if you want to catch our live show, it's going to be up for 5 days, Wet January. Go to loop.com. You can catch. We have some amazing guests. We have Rana and Beverly, my Aunt Rana, you know, Brian Safi, and some fun surprises. Amazing.
Cannot wait.
So check that out. Bye.
Dave, mm-hmm. before we get into this week's very, very, very special show, I have this a little something I'd love to do with you. I received for my birthday a tarot okay. deck, the Cosmopolitan Tarot, actually, from my sweet, sweet Casey Wilson. And
Cosmopolitan, the magazine, the yes, cocktail?
The magazine. Okay. Yeah, and the, okay. yeah, but the spirit of the cocktail is in there. You're in the right area.
Absolutely.
I'd love for you to just ask one question of the cards, and I will pull a card for you, and we'll see what they have in store.
And we'll just dive in?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm.
You know, not a yes, no question, but...
Certainly. What...
I'm shuffling.
Let's get a good shuffle on those. What is in store for my career?
What is in store?
I mean, I'm being self. I could do larger societal questions, but
I think this is a great one. And they say that when you're finished shuffling, you'll know you're finished. And I know that I just finished, and that this is your card, which is the Nine of Pentacles. So.
Nine of Pentacles. Okay.
And it's upright. And so now I just turn to my little book here and I go to the page for the Nine of Pentacles and it says, "You've worked hard. Now treat yourself. You've earned it."
Oh, so that's a kicky and fun
very
message.
Very good message, especially for career.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. It's not, sure. I can't, of course, relax and enjoy, but maybe sometime later this year. Okay, I like that. I will take it, and it does seem like something that would actually be on the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine.
Oh yeah, all of these are just the little one-liners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have a second question, if I might.
Yes. Let's. I'm shuffling again, tuning back in.
What might 2022 have in store for Jennifer Aniston?
Thank you for asking. Hard to believe I have not asked that yet. Of the cards. Oh, and we've got the Magician. The Magician.
The Magician?
No, this one might take
that. Two seem to be upright.
Yes. Yeah. The Magician. What's in store for Jennifer Aniston in 2022? You already have everything you need to make your dreams a legit reality. Huh.
Wow. Okay.
You know, I'm choosing to interpret that as that it's related to the fact that there's a new showrunner for the morning show.
Okay.
You know?
So her dreams for the morning show might finally be realized.
Yes.
In 2022.
The show might find itself in a whole new way.
They're up for a SAG Award. That could be a longtime dream.
She's won a SAG Award before, but here's hoping she gets many more.
Listen, it's never too many times. I'm so glad that we took a turn into the celestial.
That's right. And look, we can do this every week. Anytime you've got a question for the cards, let me know.
Oh, yeah, I would appreciate that. I would absolutely appreciate that. We, this week, have a guest who we have wanted to talk to forever, yep. since before we were doing this show.
Yep.
A person whose sensibility has changed our culture.
Yep.
That is not an exaggeration to say.
Not at all.
Michael Patrick King is a comedy legend. He was a performer. You can still see him occasionally at on Cabaret when that happens. But he is best known as the creator and showrunner of Sex and the City, creator of And Just Like That, and The Comeback, and
Two Broke Girls, and AJ and the Queen, on and on.
Just an absolute legend, and every bit as fascinating and revealing and interesting. And this was such a good conversation. We can't give it to you all at once. You can't handle it.
Yes. Yes, we selfishly kept him way longer than anticipated, and he was so generous with his time. And this is going to be a two-parter. You know, it simply must be, and it's going to be worth the wait. You know, think of this week as Sex and the City, and next week as And Just Like That. You know,
there you go, and he drops wisdom that you will want to sit with.
Yes.
For a little extra time before you go back to the well, which you will be doing next week.
Yeah. And, you know, he is, and you've heard me all rant about and just like that week after week, and you know that I really do worship at the altar of Sex and the City. So this was like such an emotional get for us, to have him. He's, you know what, and I want to add one caveat about when you were listing off his many, many credits. He's not actually the creator of Sex and the City, the show.
Oh, okay.
But it's I only point it out because his impact, from the jump was so significant that, you know, he is the reason that Sex and the City became what it is. Let's just say that.
Okay.
And now he is doing And Just Like That single-handedly. He did both movies, and he's just such an incredible force.
And a real good hang.
He really is. And so hope you all enjoy. I know you will enjoy this conversation with Michael Patrick King.
Michael Patrick King.
Yes, Dave.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fantastic. You are in an elegant room.
I am in an elegant room. Not to ignore Matt right away. I don't know how confident or secure Matt is, but I did.
Matt is freaking out a little bit for reasons we'll get into. So don't you worry about me. I've got a lot of questions.
We're both freaking out. We just take different approaches.
Oh, good. I hopefully have a lot of answers.
Yeah. Well, listen, you look fantastic.
You're in the perfect light as well. It's like cast perfectly across your face. Okay.
The light, honestly, it's perfume commercial. It's perfect.
I'm in my dining room in LA. That's the room I'm in.
And was this home base for you during the writer's room for the show?
Yes.
Because I know everything was over Zoom.
And Just Like That was a Zoom-based writing room for the first time. The first time I'd ever experienced that in all the writing rooms I'd been in. I was talking about intimate details with people that I had never met. I hadn't met any of the three new writers until we were actually on the set in New York City. But what I learned that I loved about running a writing room on Zoom was that everybody's an extreme close-up.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell when their eyes went dead. I could tell when they were not engaged. Rather, in a real functional writing room, people are like looking around and you have a lot of cubic space between the five of you or six of you. So I could actually pitch and see them go dead in their eyes. And I would chase that. I was like, okay, Samantha Irby, in a farmhouse in Kalamazoo, Michigan, why do you not want to do that story? And then they'd have to answer. It was a really kind of exciting in the dreaming up phase.
Right.
But in the actual production phase, when you actually get down to the scripts and start really seeing how it's all working, Zoom doesn't cut it.
Me, Zoom, the most important, the game changer in Zoom was hiding self-view. I talk about this a lot because I will just look at myself the entire time. So it's rather than being dead in the eyes, I'll just be like intensely studying and critiquing every expression.
Really? Is this thought looking good when I say it? Is this thought? I think it's better when I tip my head to the left and pitch a joke rather than when I actually tip to the right, because this is a funnier tip.
Yeah. Exactly.
Funnier tip. I'm on a homo show. Funnier tip.
That's right. You still got it. So I have a million questions about Sex and the City and Just Like That. But before we get into it, take us back and paint a little picture of young MPK for us. I know that you went to Catholic school. You were a bit of a late bloomer, literally a late bloomer.
Literally a late comer outer and a late bloomer. I came to New York when I was 20 to pursue a career as an actor. My goal was to have a movie where it says, and introducing Michael Patrick King, like, he's so young.
Yeah.
You have to be introduced. We discovered someone so early in their career that there's no way you could know them. And introducing Michael Patrick King. Meanwhile, at age 38, I still didn't have my rent. Mm. So introducing by that point was not, and it should be, and he's still here. But the fact of the matter is I came thinking I was going to be an actor, even though I had quit college in my third year, theater department. I really didn't think a theater degree from a small college in Western Pennsylvania was going to be the thing that got me to teach if I needed to teach. So I quit. Also, I had no money, so I quit. But when you look at my career, in the long term. And what you said is you were a Catholic school kid. I used to put on shows in the yard, in my backyard, and I was never in them. So that's the tell. That's the real me. I would push my three sisters, only my sisters, Ellen and Patty, would participate. My sister Eileen was always, I guess you would say, the critical eye, judging from afar, something we're all so familiar with now. But I don't get neighborhood girls in the neighborhood to do the shows, but I was never in them. I would tell them what to say and put clothes on them and move them around on the picnic table, which was the stage. But my true instinct really wasn't to perform. It was to push people around in a play or a show.
What were these early productions?
Well, religious epics, probably. It started with, I would adapt the May Crowning. I don't know if there's any Catholics listening or lapsed Catholics, probably, but the May Crowning is where you crown the Blessed Virgin statue. And it's kind of the most Game of Thrones heathen kind of a thing that's still left in the Catholic Church. Like they pick a virgin, like either a high school girl in some of the churches, the Polish churches and the Italian churches always picked like the prettiest, like Kani Kamalataki or somebody. And in my parish was St. Paul's, they picked the littlest First Communion girl, and she was dressed all in white. So you had this virgin on in the older area, she was dressed in like a wedding gown. And in the younger version, she was dressed in a communion dress, and they would crown the Blessed Virgin statue. So I co-opted that to my backyard, and I would always have my sister Patty, who was the youngest and had curly hair and was the cutest at that age. And she would be the virgin who crowned our own Blessed Virgin statue. And I would put on a suit as a producer and stand in the backyard and just go.
Little headset on.
A little headset. But, you know, the interesting thing about that whole experience is the wardrobe. My mother had three gowns. She had a wedding gown that was hers and two bridesmaids' gowns. And they were in a hanging garment bag in the attic. And that was my wardrobe department. I would get those gowns and put them on the kids. And my mother finally got so fed up with me putting on shows when I was like 10, 11, 12. She'd say, Michael, I'm going to town. When I go leave this house, do not go up in the attic and pull out all those gowns and put on a show. And I would always do it. And that's when I realized my mother was my first studio. She's like, do not go overboard in the budget. Do not write a script that's too big. And I would go, okay. But then the show would take over. I would have
always
to
speak.
I was compelled. The show had to take over.
The Blessed Virgin Mary compels you.
Yes.
I mean, she demands big production.
She does. I mean, you know, the flowers were free. They were on the neighborhood bushes. You could cut them and shove them into vases. But the costumes had to go to the wardrobe department. And when I was actually filming the movie of Sex and the City, the first one, and I was out in front of the library where Carrie was getting married. And I actually caught a moment where I was kind of fluffing SJ's wedding gown. Mm-hmm. And I realized, oh my God, I manifested the backyard again. I'm putting a wedding gown on three girls that aren't really getting married. I'm doing it. That must have been like a brain DNA lock on me that I found myself that I'm doing this again. It was trippy.
Yeah, that's like a primal feeling.
It is. It was like, wow, I guess there's a path that you kind of just keep hacking away at and you get to hacking in quotes, not actually in a judgment of the writing.
Right.
Yeah. You know, for a person who likes to put on a show, a Catholic education is so rich.
Come on. I was an altar boy. The first time I served Mass, it was a 5:30 a.m. Mass. I asked my mother to come and take a picture. And she said to me, Michael, I don't think your heart's in the right place. You know? And I was always looking over my shoulder like, I'm the holiest one. You know, like it was all a performance, all of it.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. You have to be so solemn.
Yes. And you're on a stage And sure. And you're chosen because, you know, you're an altar mm-hmm. boy. And insert joke here, you're chosen as an altar boy, hopefully not too chosen. But it was always the sort of the pomp and circumstance and the lights and the God of it all, the bigger feeling, you know.
And the drag.
Yeah. The drag
of costumery.
Did you have the bells? Did you have to do the, like, to ring the bells a couple of times?
Yeah, sure. Ring those bells.
You got to ring those bells. That was a big moment. You want to hit it at just the right second.
Yeah, well, look, I am of the generation that I was the last wave of Latin. The very last wave before the church went hootenanny. So I got that really tribal sort of magic of saying words and incense before it became all like, let's offer each other the sign of peace, and everybody gets uncomfortable that they have to shake hands with the people next to them. I was there for that transition. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Have you been back since and with your spirit?
I have. I've been back when the hands start going up now for the Our Father. They co-opted
What's
a whole.
That?
It's a Baptist thing that they sort of like co-opted the hands go up. I once went to a born again Christian church as an adult, and they were all going and lifting their hands up like to their father, and they looked like kids that wanted to be picked up by their parent.
Oh, yeah.
They're like, when you see a kid, like, pick me up. And I was like, this is crazy.
And that's exactly what the impulse is. Pick me up, daddy,
help
please.
Me. Pick me up, hold
that
me.
That is, you know, yeah, and that's honestly one thing that I always kind of loved about being Catholic was the emotional repression in a church environment. Nobody was trying to sing too loud. Nobody was trying, you know, nobody was speaking in tongues. Nobody, it was very reserved.
And in early Catholicism, you weren't even invited. You're an audience. You don't participate. You don't know the lines. Right. You're not involved. Yeah. You're not holy. Yeah. You're not holy. Just sit there. We'll work this magic around you. And you'll get some wafts of like that smell, you know, like that frankincense smell. That to me is such a powerful smell. Still, like if you go into like some of those fancier fragrance candle places, I'm always drawn to that frankincense-y smell versus like florals.
Yeah. Brings
it
you back.
Does.
Are you both Catholics?
I am. No, I mean, I grew up in a small town in Ohio where everyone was like Southern Baptist, and my parents were just atheists, but I was adopted and knew that I was, I guess, biologically Catholic. And so I did have I knew one Catholic, and I had a fascination with it because there was this sort of like, you know, sense that in another universe, I'd probably be an altar boy too.
Yeah. I mean, there's something about the discipline that is rigorous and great. I went to Catholic school and, you know, the idea of that, there's pluses and minuses to it all. But the idea of that rigorous getting shit done, like you have to get done, that there's a judge who's going to judge you and it's a nun and you better do better. And that kind of thing is kind of still very important in everyday TV.
Yeah. The nuns were your next studio, or maybe they're more the network. I don't know.
No, actually, you know, when you're running a writing room, when I did Two Broke Girls, I had all these young writers and, you know, you're like a father, you know, you go through all these things. They're projecting like crazy on you. So now you're the father. Now you're the mother. Now you're the punisher. Now you're this. And one day I was like, what am I doing? I feel a certain way. I don't feel like I'm the mother today. I don't feel like I'm the father. And I did like an inventory on myself. And all of a sudden I realized, oh, I'm the punishing nun. That's what I am. They hadn't done their homework properly. And I'm a nun. That's what I am.
What were the nuns like?
The nuns were, you know, the extremes. The first, I think, religious, maybe almost erotic experience I ever remember feeling altered. You know, when it starts to get like fuzzy and you don't know what's happening to you. And it's like a feeling. When I was in the second grade, we had a young nun, very like Audrey Hepburn in The Nun Story, but like her name was Sister Mary of Nazareth. And I remember feeling like, something about her. And then I had the punishing nuns who punched me in the face once and knocked me out of a desk. Oh, Sister St. James.
Holy.
Punched me in the
Sister
face.
Sister St. James punched you in the face.
She punched me out of the face. Boom, like this.
Here's how Catholic I am. What did you do?
I got up out of the floor and sat back at the desk and thought, I'm filing this away till I can talk in a podcast.
Yeah.
What did you do that made her have to punch you in the face?
Probably being funny or sarcastic, not respectful to the nun. Not respectful. Sure. Not respectful.
Okay. Well, you see her point in a way.
I do.
And
violence is always the answer in seventh grade.
But I'm guessing that when you were in your nun phase on Two Broke Girls, you didn't punch anybody out of their seat.
No, of course not, because I live in a world where you need to move forward in a corporate HR environment. Right. I didn't punch anyone physically,
sure.
But they sometimes felt emotionally moved by what I had to feel. Yeah,
the more brutal punch.
Yeah, I've never punched anyone.
I haven't either.
Never.
I've never had the impulse. True story. For the longest time, I was using antiperspirants, aluminum-based deodorants. I was trying to get on the natural deodorant train. I couldn't find anything that actually worked. Then I discovered Native. Now, every day, I use Native's charcoal-scented, aluminum-free deodorant. It works. It's so good. Smells great. Native's on a mission to overhaul your entire hygiene routine with products that are made with simple ingredients like shea butter and coconut oil. But their deodorant checks a lot of boxes. They're aluminum-free, 24-hour odor protection, zero residue on skin application, and they have over 10 different scents to choose from. The coconut and vanilla-scented aluminum-free deodorant is a big customer favorite. Now's the time to treat yourself. They've got body wash, bar soap, toothpaste, shampoo, conditioner, sunscreen, everything you need to take your self-care routine to the next level. This year, up your personal hygiene routine with Native. Go to nativedo.com/homophilia or use promo code homophilia at checkout and get 20% off your first order. That is nativedo.com/homophilia or use promo code homophilia at checkout for 20% off your first order. I'm curious about your pre-writing career, because as you said, acting may not have been your calling, but you did have a career as a working stand-up.
I worked as a stand-up,
and I know that you weren't out at the time, so it's not like you're talking about all the dudes you went on dates with. So what was your act like?
My act as a stand-up, I was very good. I was a good people pleaser. I was a great MC. I was a great MC, and I say great MC because it's not exactly something that you want to claim as if you're going to be a stand-up that you're a great MC, because basically you're the host of a party. You're making jokes in the minute of the room. There's no real material. You're just facilitating a festival for the other comics. And I was good at that because I'm fast. My material was borderline vanilla. I was so hidden when I was on stage. And when you're a stand-up, it's almost impossible to be hidden. It is the most aggressive light you can be in terms of self discovery or awareness. And so for me to be pushing against that, because if you're a stand-up and you're really good, you're just telling the truth. And you can get that room to a crazy level of mania and thrill. If you're, even when you're dealing with a heckler, you're telling your truth. I was not telling my truth. I was doing jokes about Catholic school. I was doing jokes about my sisters, my family, being Irish, my face caving in like a pumpkin 4 days after Halloween. All my uncles look like pumpkins 4 days after Halloween, that kind of a thing, which is charming. You're smiling. Many, many years later, when I came out and I was no longer even, I was show running and being a TV writer, I did the Uncabaret in LA, and I was out by then. And then I saw the difference between telling your truth and telling some amusing things that people wanted to hear. And that was the difference. When I was doing stand-up as a closeted, and that's in quotes, by the way, closeted performer, I was telling very smart, calculated jokes that would make an audience comfortably laugh rather than shock them with my own personal truth about yesterday I had a blowjob and, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Uncabaret has a way of making you Like she will drill down into the thing that you're trying to express.
That's what I liked about it. Beautiful way. I liked it because the thing I loved about doing on Cabaret was you couldn't do material in the truest form. You weren't supposed to do material that you'd ever done before. So it was like putting together this performance of who you are in 3 days before you do it. And then Beth would be in the back and she would pick at an area that felt ripe. And then you would go to a place that even you weren't expecting to, because when you're on stage, I don't know whether it's a survivor or your higher self, something comes out that is more formed than something you could do sitting by yourself thinking about it. It goes to a higher level of who you really are, I think, somehow.
Yeah. There's an audience. You're head up.
You're there. You're there to perform and reveal. But I was not revealing at first at all. And it was scary. One time I was performing, I was in a comedy team first. I was in an improv group. Then I went to a comedy team called King and Mende with Lisa Mende. We were very fast and funny, and we worked in comedy clubs, not in cabarets, in hard-ass comedy clubs in Jersey, Connecticut. We were at a club in Connecticut called Billy Jack's Cafe O Comedy. And I was on a stage, and the stage was covered in a shag rug that went from the floor over the stage and up the wall behind, and they had conquistador shields on the wall. And it's packed. And the part of the improv was you had to tell the audience what you were going to do. And so we had these little speeches about, we're going to make stuff up on the spot, and we'll be coming to you for suggestions. And I have on a white shirt and a black and white crazy pattern tie. And Lisa wore a black and white outfit. It's like, we were black and white. Like, look, we're wearing black and white. And I would wear like the masculine version of black and white that you could get away with. And so I'm in the middle of doing this. Well, we're going to be coming to you. And these four guys, like, I don't know, 20 some guys are at the table right in front of me. And I'm going on about, we're going to be coming to you and doing improv. And I hear one guy say, look at this fucking jerk off faggot asshole.
Oof. Oh God.
And I was just like, internally, I was like Alice in Wonderland falling down the hole, grabbing at roots, anything to stop me from hitting. And I'm still talking like, suggestions, I'm here. That was like the idea of someone seeing you for who you they say you are. And then turning that around and still pushing through it. I mean, that is really daring that I would get on stage knowing that that was always what I was afraid of. Always.
Yeah.
Always. And one time we played a gay club and I thought, well, they'll be nice. But it turned out to be a club in somebody's basement in Staten Island.
Okay.
And it was like a different type of gay. I don't know what kind it was. There was a lot of glitter t-shirts that said Manhattan, even though you could get on the ferry and go in.
Yeah.
And we were doing this exercise where you stop and fill in a like, hey, I'm here today to pick up my, and then the audience would say a word and you would use it. And they were like, faggot. And I was like, oh, I can't win.
No. Like,
this is the universe telling me, come out.
Yeah.
Dave, you sound so moved by it, Dave. You sound so moved by that.
I am. It makes me feel actual physical discomfort to hear these things. It's hard.
So when you did come out at 38, how did it go?
Yeah.
First of all, when I came out at 38, I came out at 38. I said I was out. I had a very active sex life without people knowing about it. You know, I would put on the, I don't know if you know about this, but if a closeted gay man puts on a baseball cap, they become invisible to their friends. Did you know that? You can go into any, you can walk down a street towards any gay bar, but if you have a baseball hat on, no one will see you. And you can continue your life of going in and coming out and going in and coming out. So I had on the magical baseball hat which makes you invisible to anyone you know, or you project upon that they don't
also
see.
Also makes you butch, instantly butch, you know.
For sure.
Completely.
Incredible catch. What are these venues that we're dipping into and out of?
In New York?
Set the scene.
Oh, like New York. Like New York City was like, you could walk down the street and it was like, hi, and then you're in somebody's apartment. I mean, that's the kind of thing. And the important thing about me telling you these stories is that when I was having sex, it felt so natural. as compared to, you know, the feelings around it, which were so shame-based and like, you have to hide and punish and put on baseball caps. But when I was actually having sex, it was like so freeing. So to me, when I came out late, it was really not about like, I'm so uncomfortable in my body. It was like, now I'm risking telling people that the last 18 years of who they knew was a lie. And the thing that made me hesitate for so long is I thought that if I told them that part of me was a lie, that they would assume all the other parts of me were a lie. So I didn't know how to like mitigate or parse out all of me versus the gay parts of me, because all those other parts of me are true then and still are. But I thought, well, if you're lying about this primal part, how are they not going to think everything they know about you is a lie? So that just kept me very, very worried about being completely denied. So when I told people, it was the range of expression from, I have a very working class family. My father drove beer trucks and delivered coal, and he had a great job as a janitor for the post office. My mother ran a Krispy Kreme. So they were, very fancy. She ran a Krispy Kreme.
Just thinking about the free donuts.
Which you better believe it. We would eat free donuts for breakfast and then be asleep at our desk at like 8:15, 9:15. We already crashed from the sugar. But so when I told them, I always thought my big agenda was, my goal was, is this too personal? Should I just stop talking about this? Is this interesting? I'm actually asking you.
Oh, you're asking
you guys.
Us. Oh,
is that actually you in the moment?
Yes, it is.
That's not what I said to my father. What I was saying, okay. What I always thought that my journey was, if I don't tell my father I'm gay, that I failed as a person. I always felt it was like my quest, my mythic quest. I had to tell my father, because the connection between us had been so odd and separate. And when I told them on Christmas, because, you know, why not?
Yeah.
Tell them on Christmas.
The man likes a show.
Yeah. You know, I was going to say like, hey, we always would have this fight, like the tree's not straight. And I was just going to say, neither am I. Let's move on. Uh-huh. But instead, I told my father, and my father, I'm going to get emotional, but my father looked at me, his blue eyes, with this tractor beam of love. And it was the look of like click, the look that would go with the sound of the other shoe hitting the floor. It was just like, oh. And he looked at me with so much love and acceptance. And my mother, who was so emotionally in such a love, and so you would think like that, she goes, oh, get out. Oh. And I actually had to say the phrase, I'm not kidding, I'm gay. Oh, get out. And then she started to talk. You know, like those old laser printers that make that noise as the paper's coming out. And it's just that she started making noise like crinoline slips. Shouldn't have let you play with dolls. And it took her a longer time to come to it. But everybody else, you know, that's the profound reaction. And the other reactions are like, oh, why didn't you tip my duh?
Yeah.
And like, oh, I'm so sorry you waited so long. You know, like it was like the ship had sailed. So it was every reaction in the world. But what you get out of it is the power. I mean, what can they do to you now?
Exactly.
What can you do once you've chosen yourself over society and your family?
Yeah.
What can happen to you? I mean, what's that compared to the reviews for Sex and the City 2?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
You can survive it all.
You can pull my skin off and wear it around like a party hat if you want. But the reality is I already have been through a rigorous self-examination. And of course, you're adding to the journey. But really, that's the power of coming out, is that your face, it's mythic. You're now you. And you've slayed everybody to this point. And then you have other battles and things you have to come up with. But
of course.
Well, let's talk about the show. I just to give you some context of my level of fandom, I'm getting married in May, and there's going to be a reading.
What's her name?
Her name's Michael.
I don't like to assume. Just
I appreciate that.
It's marketing,
it's because of my baseball cap threw you off.
It's very fresh to constantly be just changing it up. So I just wanted to check.
You never know.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Dave, are you married?
I am partnered.
For how many years?
16.
Oh, I'm 20. Not married.
Wow.
20 years not married, yeah.
20
okay,
years.
Okay. Okay. All right.
Okay, back we're going to be circling back to that.
Oh, we'll get into it.
I just, you know, having four of my closest girlfriends do a reading of the sacred text in the ceremony. So,
is that true?
It's true. Yes, and I love and just like that in a way that in this moment, and it's insane for me to even say this, but I kind of love it even more than Sex in the City. And part of it, I think, is just the sheer high of getting to be with my friends in the present day every week. Mm-hmm. But there is also something about that, you know, of course, the show has always been about these friendships at its core. And like those friendships are deeper now in a way that they can't be when you're in your 30s, you know, that they have now like walked through these incredible losses together. And, not a question, just I love it so much. I'd be remiss if I didn't say that.
Well, thank you. The thrust of the thesis of when I wanted to come back really is how your friends are there for you when the worst thing that can happen to you in life, which is death, happens. And, you know, aside from the dramatic explosion that I knew it would be of, spoiler alert, killing Mr. Big, the idea about what your friends are when you're going through a huge loss. I remember that, like, at both my parents' funerals, what really drove me emotionally to the top was when all of a sudden you look up and a friend walks in. I mean, one of my favorite episodes of the Sex and the City series was when Miranda's mother dies. And she has no one to walk down the aisle with. Oh, and Carrie jumps out. That's so ballsy and defiant, and takes her hand. And I always felt a great deal about how important it is, especially, you know, when you're going through life not coupled up or not societally chosen, to have friends that become the partners and the strength. So the idea that Carrie was going to suffer this loss and that her friends are going to be there for her. And then also the other amazing thing to explore is that your friends are not there for you. And you're basically, we're all got to be our own person, which is, you know, and I've said this before, and people forget that Sex and the City ended. People have done, they're putting so many transparencies over the series now, their own personal transparencies, that it all ended when they were happy and in love. And then if you want to write the negative, you're like, oh, it was always about getting married and finding a couple. Well, it wasn't. Carrie's last voiceover is, the most significant relationship you have of all is the one you have with yourself. And if you find somebody else, that's great. So now the fun, exciting drama of this, the comedy of drama of this, is that she is alone and her friends can't be there for her and all the time.
Yeah.
And it was a great extravagant adventure to come back and do this, just from the story point of view, because it's so rare to have characters that people believe are their friends. Like you said, the sacred text, to have characters that you already love and you've invested in, and then you can actually come back and pick up with them. It's, from a writing point of view, it's so potent. And that's what we're seeing as the reaction. It's like, well, this isn't my Miranda. This isn't my Carrie. Well, it is. It is your Carrie. It is just a choice that we made for what they're experiencing. But I think it's really been thrilling to see a dialogue again. There's a dialogue.
Big time.
Big time.
And how have you sort of navigated the noise? Because we're at the time that we're recording this, there's, I think, two more episodes left.
No, seven. We just finished seven.
Right. Three more to air. But, you know, the conversation around it, and everyone's got a hot take and everyone's got a think piece. How have you kind of managed that?
First of all, I am incredibly excited that there's actually a conversation that is still happening. Because what tends to happen now is it's here and gone. I mean, there are massive movies that people spent 5 years on that come on Netflix and you watch it and that's it. You got maybe 2 days and no one's, even if they liked it, no one's angry or excited enough to write about it. So it's an interesting return to old school television that the HBO Max parses them out once a week. And I'm seeing that drumbeat is really important to making it feel like it used to feel, like where you're not able to just sit down with a big bowl of candy and just shove it in your mouth and then be like sick to your stomach afterwards and not think about it. You actually have to, if you're lucky, wait to see what happens next week. So the dialogue is, you know, thrilling because it's everything from I'm going to kill you for even attempting this to with like pitches and torches at the gate to I miss them so much. I'm happy to see them to these aren't my versions of them to these are my versions of them. And what I'm seeing is the evolution of the conversations. And I surf it rather than deep dive it. I know what's out there. I look at the headlines and I go, oh, love, hate, love, la, la, da, 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 dee, da, 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 da. And I'm far enough along now on this particular show where I'm so happy with the boldness of it, the boldness of each episode. And I know that there's something in each episode that will create a thing. So I'm grateful for the conversation. And I think it's kind of telling what's happening that I'm seeing is there'll be a whole movement, the episode before Miranda gets fingered, where people are like, they're afraid to do sex.
Right.
And then that next week, Miranda's having like the most graphic paleontological orgasm that anyone's ever heard, but it's just the week before they're ready. So I think it's an interesting conversation, and I'm choosing to invest in the fact that people are talking about it. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. And the conversation around it is like, is evolving over time. Like it's, you know, it, because it is such a different show with such familiar characters. It like, I think at first people were like, I don't know how to react. And like, and because it is unfolding week after week and it is revealing itself to be what it is and what it's about, it's like people are approaching it the way that they used to approach television, where it's like, let us let this story evolve and not decide right away, you know, what it is or isn't.
I think what's interesting about criticism right now is that everybody assumes that whatever the first episode is, that's, you're done. Like you're just, the creators are just going to drive the car into a brick wall now. Like if there's no path, there's no thought to like, how are we layering this? People just assume whatever the first one is the experience, and that everybody's unhinged because so much of television, you go like, oh, what happened? Ooh, the third episode was like a whole new show suddenly. And the idea that somebody's driving with a room of writers and we kind of have a map of what we want people to experience, like the last episode, episode seven, where she goes on a date. The conversation around that is like, oh, here's the one you've been waiting for. Mm. Well, but if we had done this first, you'd be like, that's pathetic. She's going on a date. She can't get a date. Why is she even dating? She's 55. Why is she dating? What's that about? Why is she on an app? Come on. She can't find a date. But the fact of the matter is we got her to the date so that now people feel like, oh, it's back. It's the show we missed. Well, if I had given you the show you missed in episode one, and I did sort of in that first scene, the first scene of them at the restaurant where they're talking about, oh, I stepped in semen and dyed her hair and Ruth Bader Ginsburg dyed her hair. Snappity, snap, snap, snap. Sex in the City. Look at it on the page. It's snap, 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 snap. If I had done that every scene, people would be in a worse state now because they would have said, it's dead. It's over. It's old. It's the same. Who cares? What they're not saying is, it's over. Mm. They're saying, what?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No, I reject it. No, it's not over. Carrie would never do that. Miranda would never do that. What about Steve? Poor Steve. What about Steve? And the other thing about the show that's so interesting is people don't remember the show. They're remembering the show on E.
Right.
They're remembering the show on, you know, syndication, where the sex is cut out. And it's kind of like Love in the City. It's like Girlfriends in the City. And because of all the sex stuff, people have forgotten. And now I hear a lot of viewers in their 20s are going back and watching the HBO Max ones. And they're kind of like the old one on the way it was designed to be seen without commercials. It's a fucking shit show for them. I mean, everybody's talking about Miranda's sexuality. Cynthia Nixon was the first person to fucking show her boob to a gay guy across the hall through a window across the street that she was trying to pick up at the deli. And then she sees he has a lover and he's gay. I mean, Cynthia was talking dirty talk and talking about somebody tonguing her ass, tuchus lingus, in a coffee shop. It was this. It was this. It was a mess. It was easier, maybe, because I think, and I'm starting to form theories if anybody's interested. In the first series, the villain was being single, and everybody was comfortable having someone speak up for single people. Because it was like, yeah, guys are terrible, or it's hard, or I'm embarrassed. But they were 34. Now the villain is society's feelings about aging and being a woman. And it's not as easy, maybe, to look at. And, you know, I've been down this, like, first level rejection with the comeback that I did with Lisa Kudrow, where people saw Valerie Cherish as being I'm too hard. I don't want to watch this. It's like the way people respond to the Miranda in her first day of school scene. I'm so uncomfortable that she would embarrass herself like that. It's something they're not used to seeing. And maybe age is upsetting people because they're not perfect at 55. They're still flawed as they were at 34. I think it's really fascinating because the old show was a mess.
Yeah.
By design. They were lost.
Yes.
And strong.
Absolutely.
But lost.
And they're still both in many ways.
Homophilia is a World of Wonder production, produced and edited by Kate Moldenhauer.
Special thanks to Randy Barbato, Fenton Bailey, Stephen Sims, Edward Bochniak, and the whole team at World of Wonder. We love you!
And theme music by my Ben Wise.
Yes, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HomophiliaPod. You can give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for listening. We love you!